Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program. Hello, listeners. Thank you for joining us. Mike Consul here with Beth Barani. Beth came to my attention because she was talking creativity. That's a subject we haven't tackled, but is obviously critical to being a good fiction writer, being a good writer maybe of any stripe. But I've came to find that Beth is into a lot of different things on the writing front, not just creativity. She's got a coaching site. She's got a Writer's Fun Zone blog. I see that you're connected. I mean, you have separate URLs for BookBub, Goodreads, Instagram, Twitter, and so on. So how would you define yourself, Beth? I mean, you're a writing coach. You're an author. You write sci-fi novels, right? And fantasy.
Yep.
And maybe I should have you introduce yourself. Go right ahead, Beth. Tell our listeners who you are. You're so wide-ranging. We need to narrow the focus down just a little bit, but definitely want to talk about creativity.
Absolutely. Well, let me start with that. So I am a creativity coach for writers with a specialty in helping genre fiction writers. And I help people write, market, and publish their books to the delight of their readers. And that, in a nutshell, to the delight of the readers, you know, that's what we write for.
So why genre writers? I mean, you're specific about that. What's the difference? I mean, obviously, there's a difference between somebody who says, I'm writing literature and I hop from subject to subject versus a genre writer. But why genre? I know you're a genre writer. Do you just feel like that's your wheelhouse? And what's how do you differentiate that from the general fiction writer?
Sure. Well, people usually identify themselves as a very specific kind of writer, like I write romance, or I write thrillers, or I write mysteries. And it turns out between my husband and I, and he co-teaches with me in my business, between the two of us, we have all the genres covered. And by genre, I mean, when you go to a bookstore or you browse online, people are usually looking for a specific kind of book. They can tell you, oh, I want a mystery. Oh, I want a cozy mystery. Oh, I love those spicy romances. Or, oh, just give me those thrillers. You know, oh, I love the international thrillers like so-and-so author. So genre fiction is, it's kind of an inside baseball term. So maybe people who inside of the industry are using this to talk about thrillers, mysteries, science fiction, fantasy, romance, horror, and all the permutations that includes. So really, we're writing the page turners. We're writing the beach reads. We're writing books for people who read a book a day. You know, we are really writing these books that have predictable endings, right? If I say I'm writing romance, boom, everyone knows happily ever after. If I say I'm writing, like I am writing science fiction, police, you know, mysteries, people know that probably means I'm solving a mystery in every book and probably a murder mystery. So a genre, any genre, including literary fiction, they have certain reader expectations with them. That's why they're a genre. And I just happen to be working in and know intimately these page-turning type books. And that's what I love. And that's where I play. And that's what I teach. And I also
emphasize play. I know that that's a big part of it for you. But before we talk about play, before we start playing, let's talk about why sci-fi for you. What I mean, is it just, hey, from the time I was a girl, I was into the, you know, Star Trek and all that, or what?
Absolutely. And I have to say, one of my early influences, two early influences in science fiction were from radio plays. One, everyone will recognize, is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So I'm a child of the 70s, and I listened to that, firstly, as a radio play. That was amazing. Super fun and funny and silly, over the top. Really, really fun. The second one, I don't know if a lot of people know about Ruby the Galactic Gumshoe. I just loved her. Again, a radio play. It still exists. You can still find it online. Ruby the Galactic Gumshoe. Just really also a little darker, a little bit odder. and very much a mystery. And so these two were probably my earliest influences that I recall about science fiction, sort of the hilarity of it, and also kind of this wide-ranging, like, oh, the human race might get erased by an intergalactic freeway. And then this sort of darker, little sexier Ruby the Galactic Gumshoe. So those, yeah, really stand out for me. And then, of course, I became a Star Wars, you know, I got to see Star Wars and when it first came out into the theater, in what, 78, something like that. Yeah. And then Star Trek, I wasn't influenced directly by the first Star Trek, because that was before my generation, but definitely Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, loved them so much. And
You know, I got to say that I love Douglas Adams. I love his audiobooks because he reads them, and he reads them in a way that nobody else could read them because he knows exactly where all the inflections belong. He reads fast and hot, and God rest his soul. Sorry that he departed so early, but his stuff, especially Hitchhikers is not my favorite. By far, my favorite is Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, which is just hilarious listening to him read it. And then Long Dark Tea Time for the Soul is another one that's just wonderful. And, you know, basically those are books that an awful lot, other than the beginning and end, you could basically say, is this really science fiction? It just sounds like funny, comedic fiction, general fiction. But is it the beginning and end where he really says, okay, this is science fiction. This is, you know, space travel, or it's something otherworldly or what have you. I don't know if you agree with that, but let's talk about play.
Yeah, let's talk about play.
Why play? What's the import of play? I would imagine that creativity and play go very much together.
Absolutely. I mean, you could say from the time we're young and we're exploring the world, we play. And what does that play look like? Well, it's invention, whether we're drawing pictures or playing with our made-up games with our friends or running around, playing hide and seek, but in our imagination, we're like spies and or whatever. Every kid I've ever met, and certainly when I was a kid and then later, they are constantly inventing, creating. I think our natural human state is to be creative, and that creativity from the outside, we call it play. And anytime you're doing anything where you're putting two disparate ideas together and you're like, what would happen if I put, you know, a dragon under the city of Paris? Oh my God. And then stories can like bubble up from that. And that's the basis of one of my little romances, paranormal romances. It, to me, most people, as soon as you put two things that don't normally go together, you put them together in a sentence, people naturally will find interesting things there. And so I think play is just another name for creativity and vice versa. And as adults, people forget how to play. They forget to take joy. You know, it's joyful.
Well, first the adults tell us our imaginary friends aren't there. We're imagining them. They take our imaginary friends away, not knowing that we see these apparitions, and that's actually a good thing. And then, you know, we have to start doing jobs, and it's repetitive work. Saps a lot of the fun out of, and I've said this before, when it comes to English classes, learning how to write, they take all the joy out of writing by saying the rules and regulations instead of let your imagination soar, be brave, be courageous, be inventive, create the character who you wish your imaginary friend used to be or what have you. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's, oops, you missed a period, you missed a comma, that's, you know, the gerund, you violated the rules of gerunds and crazy stuff like that. We have to, of course, know that stuff, but after we really create. You probably know this fella named Roger Von Eck. He's a creativity consultant. He wrote a book called A Whack on the Side of the Head. And he talks all about how, really very much in line with what you're saying, which is why I bring him up, that we need to play. And he gives examples about, it's just a round ink spot on a page. And they say to adults, what do you see there? What is that? And they say it's a rounding spot on a white page. And they ask kids and they say, what's that rotten egg? It's the top of a telephone pole. It's this, it's that. They come up with all these different interpretations of it because they're not afraid to sound stupid. They're not being stupid. They're being imaginative.
Exactly.
But if you're sitting in a with adults and you say, well, I think that's at the top of a telephone pole. They're going, where do you get that?
Yeah.
Well, why do we do that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have to say that, you know, I was a very serious, studious kid and young adult. And when I started writing fiction, I realized I had to start stretching my imagination. And at first it wasn't stretching very far. And then I started hanging out with more and more writers. And I met this one writer who at the drop of any word, he could make up a story. And it was always funny and silly and bizarre sometimes and goofy. And then I started hanging out with him and I loosened up and I realized that I had been wearing my serious hat because I'm the eldest in my family. And that's very common with firstborn. They're very serious, very responsible. Mm-hmm. And hanging out with this guy, I just started loosening up and realizing that because I was taking myself so seriously, I was actually blocking my own creativity. I didn't quite, you know, think of it in those terms at first. I just started enjoying hanging out with him who, you know, now 22 plus years later, he's my husband. I've been with him for quite a long time. And I call him Insta creative. It's like press a button and out comes something hilarious and silly and funny and out from left field. And that really helped me reconnect to my playful spirit and recognize that that's where all the juice is and the joy and the power and the passion. And I already knew I could like think my way out of a lot of interesting, challenging issues. But now with creativity on my side, with playfulness, it felt like sky's the limit. Literally, you know.
So, yeah. So your husband is probably the kind of guy, Mr. Barani is probably the guy who, or Mr. Doe, whatever his
Ezra.
Name is.
You can call him Ezra's his name.
Yeah, Ezra. So Ezra's probably the kind of guy that a lot of other women would say, he's a really strange guy. And you completely took to his bursts of creativity.
Absolutely.
He says things that are a little abstract or off the wall. And a lot of other women would look at him strangely probably, but he found the woman who says, this is a guy who is not in a suit of armor. He's like free.
Yeah. There's a freedom there. And really he thinks, he calls them non sequiturs and actually a lot of people enjoy them. He makes people smile. He also sings a lot. He's a singer by training. So his sort of way in the world is happy and silly. And also, I mean, he's got his serious side. He's a high school physics teacher. But he imagine taking a physics class from someone who makes up silly stories about a penguin falling from the moon, you know, when you're learning the, you know, force equals mass times acceleration or whatever, right? Like,
wow, Ezra's Guide to the Galaxy.
There you go. So if you have fun and you know how to play and you take joy in that, everything actually becomes so much easier, even the things that feel the hardest. And so there's sort of that kind of mashup when I teach people how to write fiction and edit fiction and everything. It's like, okay, yes, we have some serious fun around here because we take it, we're serious about it, we're rigorous, we're professional, and we have fun. So how about that? You know, put those two things together that aren't normally together and let's make some magic. Let's invent, let's create, let's move hearts and minds through our stories. It's a lot of fun.
So short of finding a spouse who's going to help you stretch your creativity, there's a lot of people these days, particularly in Silicon Valley, looking for creativity and they microdose with mushrooms or LSD. Meditation has been pointed to as a source of creativity. There's thinking and writing exercises. When somebody comes to you and just says, look, I know I'm more creative than I'm actually expressing. How do I get there? What's your approach to something like that? I don't know if you have people actually say that, but let's say that somebody does come to you and said, I see your creativity person and coach. So
yeah,
how do I get there?
Yeah, well, I have written, you know, I have a book, Overcome Writer's Block. I have another book, Plan Your Novel Like a Pro. Both of these are very organic, step-by-step processes to help you unlock your creativity and your mojo. So usually what I do is, if I'm working one-on-one with someone, I'll probably explore with them and have them paint that picture that they really want. So that's the first step, really, is to take some time, visualize, feel into what you really wish for. What are you yearning for? What is that creative life or those creative activities? You know, paint that picture put it up on the big screen in your imagination and walk me through that scenario. So that's the first thing that I would help someone do. So I have a clear sense and they have a clear sense of where they want to go. And we, through that, we are already activating the imagination. And then I'll play with them a little bit more. I'll ask them to like deepen into the five senses and ask them to walk around in that story through what they see, what they hear, and what they feel, what they taste, what they smell. And as you do that, the brain is so amazing. The brain starts making it real. The brain is like, oh, because to the brain, there is no difference between the imagination and reality. When the brain is perceiving it, it is real to the brain. And that's how we make fiction so powerful, because we're using the five senses to ground reality, this other reality up in space or elves or some crazy alternative story, reality, whatever. We bring it real because we are talking about the five senses. So that's where I would start with someone, is really let them walk around in their vision. And
bringing the senses into it, like you're saying, is that alone, because there's so many people who write that they don't think in terms of, well, instead of telling people what's happening, why don't I actually let them feel some of this or smell some of it, have some auditory, some sounds around what's happening. So that's missing a lot of the time. So I suspect once you engage their senses in their own creation, they start to, what you're saying is they start, it starts to become real. And now stuff starts to happen.
Absolutely. It's very incredible. And I can tell when I'm working with writers that they're expanding their vocabulary. You start to say, well, how is your character feeling? And they're like, I don't know, happy. I'm like, great. What kind of happy? Is it joyous? Is it giddy? Is it euphoric? Is it calm and serene with a big smile, right? So each one of those words has another flavor, has another texture. And as we write fiction, the more specific we are, the more we're transmitting and the more we're allowing the reader to step into that experience. Mm-hmm. It's quite incredible.
So to our listeners, Beth introduced me to Voxer. I didn't even know about that app until just recently, and we've been going back and forth on Voxer. I mean, who needs another app? But this is a fun one. And when she would be leaving her messages to me, the audio messages, I could just hear her. She was a little huffing and puffing, a little out of breath, and I'm thinking she's walking and talking. I checked that with her, and yes, indeed, she likes to talk while she walks. And I know from my own experience, Beth, that walking can be a real brain stimulation, can be a real source of creativity. I would walk, and suddenly I'd start just to take a break, and I would suddenly, these ideas would be coming to me. And then I started walking with a recorder so I could capture the ideas. Brain engagement or brain stimulation is so important. And yet, as writers, almost everybody sits in a chair sedentary. And being sedentary, I think, is an enemy to creativity or creative writing.
Yeah. I have a ritual.
You sound dubious about that.
No,
I'm not sure you agree with me.
I totally agree. I want to quote you this quote, so I was trying to find it, but let me paraphrase. Einstein has this amazing quote. He says, the legs are the wheels of creativity. And forgive me if I have that wrong. Oh. I used to have it on my wall. But this is very much my ritual, is if I want to write, my first instinct is to get up and walk. So I have a routine. I've paired it where it's walk and write. And my brain knows, like, oh, I'm going to go write. Okay, first I need to take a walk. Because, yes, we sit so much. The human beings are not designed to be sitting in chairs for so long. We're actually designed to be active. So walking for me is where I really, it's almost like shaking a shaker or doing the dishes. Like there's this energetic shift and energy is moving, it's pumping, my heart is pumping, and things kind of move around. So that by the time I'm done with my walk, I'm like, it's like a mental, emotional cleanse. Plus I got to be outdoors, and that somehow, earth is an incredible healer. And even in some countries, doctors prescribe taking nature walks as a way to help with mental health and wellness. It'd be nice if we had that here. I totally agree with it. A lot of what ails us is because we're sitting glued to our devices, and our devices are not human. Our devices entrain us to basically disconnect from our bodies and just be kind of in the ethereal and in the abstract and in the mental, which is a part of us, but isn't all of us. So, I mean, I'm guilty of that.
The disconnect from nature. I mean, we're so removed from nature. So when you're walking, are you walking on sidewalks? Are you walking on hiking trails? You live in the Bay Area. I know that. So the weather's good and there's tons of hiking trails, but they're not always convenient to, you know, there's just the walk out the door in your walking sort of thing. That's part of the beauty of walking. You don't, it doesn't really require any prep.
Exactly.
Unless you're doing something very specific. But what about just a connection, even if you're walking down sidewalks? I mean, there's trees and there's
absolutely
cats and dogs and what have you.
Yeah, I'm blessed with this neighborhood I live in. It's very hilly, lots of yards, lots of flowers, lots of animals. I live not too far from the oldest cemetery in Oakland. So when that's open, I go there. It's urban, but also lots of trees and lots of birds. And so I don't have to go very far. I live very close to the Oakland Rose Garden, 20-minute walk to Lake Merritt. I actually don't go to Lake Merritt anymore. I love walking on hills. So I live on a hill. So I can just leave my house and walk, you know, 10 minutes to this path that goes by a dog park, by the grammar school, by the Rose Garden, you know, all these wonderful areas. I can walk, you know, in 10 minutes in any direction, 10 minutes back, boom, I have my 20-minute walk. I've gotten some cardio in. I've talked out a problem to one of my friends through Voxer. And sometimes I'll just talk to myself too. And then sometimes I'll be quiet or sometimes I'll listen to a podcast.
You know, Do you do some actual writing sometimes?
Yes.
Where you're writing and recording.
Yep.
A big, big chunk of the, maybe the majority of the first book I ever wrote was walking. It was when I discovered, wow, I get up from writing and I go for a walk and I'm having the quality of my ideas or thinking is much better while I'm walking.
Yes.
That's when I got, I didn't even have a smartphone at the time. So I got a digital recorder and started capturing it. And what a revelation that was for me. So you actually do some writing while you're walking.
Yes,
you may
nonfiction.
Be thinking about a scene or whatever.
Well,
nonfiction, okay.
Nonfiction. So I'll dictate the weekly newsletter, or I'll dictate replies to clients, or I'll dictate an idea for something. I rarely dictate fiction because it's so different. And it takes a lot of brain power. I've tried it a few times and the end result wasn't very good, but I will brainstorm fiction either with a friend through Voxer or with myself. Talk out like I'm not really sure how to handle this next moment in the story. I could do this, I could do that. You know, I'll talk out the options and then find an answer through that. But I know there are some writers, it's amazing. There's some writers you can dictate 10,000 words a day and therefore you could like be done with a novel in, you know, a week or so. It's quite incredible. And I know a lot of writers use that. They do a lot of planning ahead of time. So they're able to do that and they dictate fiction. They dictate prose. And that's incredible.
Mm. Now, you do send out a tremendous amount of emails. I signed up for your emails and there's like an email every day. So you are doing a lot. I don't know if that's boilerplate in your Mike is on a different schedule. He just signed up. So there's this whole inventory of thousands of emails that he's going to be receiving day by day. I don't know if you have a robot working for you. I mean, like,
no.
It's an automated, or you're just tremendously prolific, which would, you know, depress me that I'm not as prolific as that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. People say that about me, but actually, I mean, depending on when you signed up, there's been a lot of events lately. So it's actually going to slow down. Like I was part of a summit at the Fiction Marketing Academy. I ran a little event this week. I was part of a summit last week, Midlife Uprising Summit for middle-aged women getting inspired. And
so these are freshly minted.
Yeah, those are very, very new, May 2022. And a lot of that content, anything that's announcing someone else's event, they wrote, I didn't write. And yes, it ebbs and flows. When there's events, like we have a big fall class, the 60-day novel, we promote that a lot. And there is automated stuff. So if you signed up and you got one of our automated things, like one of our freebies, the 10 ways to jumpstart your writing, or the 5-day mini writer's motivation class, then those little pieces are all automated. I wrote those years ago and you're being, you know, walked through and invited in. So I use the autoresponders a lot for those kind of things. Or if you signed up for a class through the online school, Barani School of Fiction, then again, that's all preset. You know, I wrote those previously and you're getting welcomed in.
Do you ever feel as though, because you're doing so much of this other stuff, the coaching and all, that it is a form of, or potentially a form of procrastination? Like, I'm so busy with this stuff and I'm on the hook for this stuff, I just don't have time to write. Now, you don't strike me as a person who isn't producing the fiction, but do you ever feel that, because one of the other enemies of creativity is being too busy or not getting enough sleep at night and depleting your energy and so on. I don't want to drag you down a bad rabbit hole here, but I'm just saying, does that ever cross your mind? Because people do things like that as a form of procrastination.
Sure.
I mean, it does.
Absolutely.
Happen. I'm not saying it happens with you.
Well, I've definitely been there. I've definitely noticed, especially when I started my business, I felt this huge tug of war between having the business, helping writers, and being a writer myself. And for a long time, those two things were like fighting for territory. They were at odds. And over the years, I have come to a new relationship with my writing. I am actually a midday writer. I love working on my novel midday, well, usually starting anywhere from about 11:30 a.m. up to maybe 2 p.m. generally. That's when I put on my writing hat as a novelist. That's my
What are those hours again? I'm sorry.
Yeah, 11:30 a.m. to about 2 p.m.
Uh-huh. That's your window.
That's my window. That's like I advise writers to write at your best time. And your best time could be different from my best time. Some best time writers, for some people, that's the early morning. For some, that's late at night. For some, it's, you know, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. For some, and then there's some people like my husband, Ezra, he can write anytime, anywhere. That's a magic. That's a gift. I found that my brain generally turns off for my own fiction around 10 p.m. But even after dinner, it's like, I don't really want to be working on my fiction. I'll work on other people's fiction. So I just learned through trial and error that I'll have lunch and then I'll write or edit.
Now, do you have this, what's your thinking on this? I think it was Ernest Hemingway who said that when he is done writing, I mean, he'd sit in a cafe and write, or a bar, the American Bar in Paris or whatever, American Grill, I think was the name of it. I've been there. I was there. I got the vibe. So he says, I finish and I don't think about it. I stop thinking about it. I don't want to think about it until I pick it up the next day and I start fresh. But then I hear there's many people who their mind can't get off of it anyway, and things will just trickle in. And it might come at night in a dream. It might come in the evening while watching TV, and maybe a character on the TV says something that springs the mind into action. Do you walk away from the writing and say, we're done for now and on to other things? Or do you leave yourself open to whatever the ether might deliver?
Yeah, I generally am ready to move on to other things. Partly that's, I've sat for an hour, I need to get up. Partly, I feel, the client meeting or the client call, or, this other project I'm working on, getting curriculum ready for a new class. So I do feel that. And I also work really hard to create a sense of the story inside of myself. So for example, right now I'm editing a short story that's a little bridge story between the book for that I just published this spring and the next book that I haven't yet written, but I'm brewing. And I can like feel that the story is alive inside of me, which it makes me really, really happy. And I can feel the anticipation for the work. Like I'm right in the middle of a scene right now editing it, and I can feel that. And I love that. And so I work really hard to get to that place where the story is waiting for me to work on it, because I'm one of those writers who thinks by doing. I can't be always thinking about it abstractly. I really have to be in there. I really have to be in the story. I have to be editing to make it manifest. Not everybody's like that. I watch my husband like lie in bed for an hour thinking about a story, getting really super clear about everything, and then producing it. And then writing it or editing it.
It sounds like what you're saying is, with you, when you're into the story or it's in you, it's percolating subliminally and working some things out. And then when you sit down to write, there's some deliverance there.
Yeah. Because I actually did stop with a little bit of a challenge yesterday. I was like, I'm not quite sure how I want to play this out. I'm basically was rewriting a scene, and I realized I'm stuck. So instead of feeling frustrated about that, I'm like, all right, I need to let this, you know, cook on the back burner. I really need my subconscious to percolate on this and feel into it. So that's the first thing I reach for is like, what is the emotional experience here that I'm having that I want this scene to do? Like there's a plot thing the scene has to do. There's an emotional thing the scene has to do between my characters. And I don't intellectualize it. I don't need it to be in the front of my mind. I just need it to be percolating. And my body kind of tells me, like, again, back to the physical, my body is like, yeah, working on it. And I just trust that. And I anticipate sitting down to write. Now, because of today's schedule and other commitments, I don't have the same lunchtime pocket, but that's okay. Because I also know that even if I give myself, you know, 20 minutes later today, but before about 6 or 7, I can get it in there. My body will be ready. And if not, I can hold it till, you know, tomorrow or Monday even.
I love that you're saying my body, not my mind or my brain, because one of the things we've discovered is that, for instance, memories exist in the muscles. Our memory is not just strictly a brain function, that we're a whole body experience, and that memory actually lives in the musculature, not necessarily in the gray matter. Mm-hmm. So you actually feel it physically. You feel it.
Yeah.
Now let me ask you about, go ahead.
Well, expand. I didn't really realize that about the muscle conscious limit, but I have experienced it myself. Like even having acupuncture once, you know, they put the needle in and all of a sudden this memory popped from very young that from some hand surgery, because I had to have a lot of hand surgery when I was a kid. It's like, wow, like all of a sudden I had an incredibly vivid visceral memory that had been locked away. It was very intense.
Boy, it sounds like it. Now, let me ask you about this. You had said earlier, lunch. And when I think of eating, I think of after eating, I'm sluggish, and I don't really feel that would be a creative time. Does the lunch come at the end of your writing window, or is it in the middle of it, and you're fine and dandy to continue writing after eating lunch and while the body's digesting and using up a lot of energy on digestion?
I write right after lunch. That's ideal for me. I eat generally really healthy. I don't eat wheat. I found that wheat would make me sleepy. And as soon as I stopped eating wheat, maybe about, 7 or 8 years ago, I noticed I never had that after lunch slump anymore. I had energy. And so I'm eating vegetables, I'm eating protein, you know, boom, I'm good. I feel like a thoroughbred, or maybe that's not the right example, but I feel like I could go all day long. And
so it fuels you. You feel energized by the food you're eating.
I do.
Rather than sluggish. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I got to get off the carbohydrate. It's hard to do. I'm a vegetarian, so it's hard to get off the
Not carbs. I eat carbs. Like I'll have potatoes or whatever, but it's wheat specifically. So no bread, you know, no pasta, very little rice. Although rice has a different kind. Doesn't have
a little sensitivity.
Gluten sensitive.
It sounds like
exactly. And it's just turned my life around. Totally helped me have more consistent energy all day long.
Portion size also counts, don't you? Yeah, like if you eat a big lunch, even if it's healthy, if it's a big lunch, which is part of my problem too, that's what I tend to do. Look, I come from a family where the boys in the family all eat fast and they eat big. And a lot of carbohydrates and not necessarily complex carbohydrates.
Right. And lunch may not be your writing time. You know, your best writing time might be early in the morning or late at night, right? So I haven't met a lot of people. Yeah, out of necessity.
Out of necessity for me, because if I don't get it done early, like first thing, then my day gets away from me. I mean, it happened today. I mean, when we first sat down, I was a little discombobulated because we almost had to delay the recording of this podcast because I've got a tire on the car that had a slow leak. And it's like, I got to get this taken care of. I've got a couple long drives coming up this weekend, all that kind of stuff. You know, your day just will take over. And so I just find that I need to do it right away. And then I can be at peace with it. And it makes the rest of the day a lot simpler, generally speaking, anyway. What's your relationship to cafes?
I love working in cafes. I go to cafes almost every day. And in fact, I was there today.
Is that your locale? Is that your venue for writing? Your window there? Are you 80% of the time in cafes?
Cafes, or since lunchtime is my writing period, I often will go to the local diner and have lunch and then write at that diner. Or sometimes I'll go to another cafe. Or lately, sometimes I'll have lunch at home and then I'll go sit out on the patio. I love to work outdoors also and work. But I almost every day I'm going to the cafes to work, whether it's in the morning slot or the lunchtime slot. And then usually I'm home for the afternoons. That's generally the way it is. And then, you know, my husband and I, for us, a play date is to go to a diner, some other town nearby, have a wonderful meal, write for an hour or two, and then like go out to a movie. Like that was before the pandemic, our ideal kind of date, because that made us happy. We got to work on our own stories and then we'd go out and enjoy, you know, someone else's story.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So playtime is something, getting back to play and playtime, you regard writing as playtime. Mm-hmm. Talk about that a little bit in terms of most writers, and I think I'm safe in saying most writers find writing as onerous. It's a labor of love. It's stressful at times. It's hard work. I'm not playing. I'm working hard. And this thing is bedeviling me because I'm trying to get this or that accomplished and I don't feel like I'm productive enough. And, you know, all the tapes that run in people's heads. Because you teach, I mean, you coach.
Yeah, absolutely.
So talk about how, when you're writing, can you kind of transport us there and talk about how writing is playful, how you can make the actual act of writing playful?
Yeah, that's such a great question because, yes, I also can relate to all the ways in which writing is hard and all the ways in which the tape runs and doubting and complaining and wondering and questioning. So one of the tools that I use, and I often use this still with myself, is I will journal to write. And that's actually what I call it, journal to write. So basically it's free writing and I'll set the timer for 10 minutes or 20 minutes. I love 20 minutes. And I will just kind of command myself to play in this little sandbox of free writing, meaning I can write whatever, however. But my intention is by the end of this free writing period, I will have sort of vented and I will be ready to write. And sometimes I'm working out a knotty problem inside of the story, but in this free writing format. Or sometimes I'm just complaining, or sometimes I'm just meandering, writing a to-do list. But the goal here is it's like a warm-up. I am free writing for 20 minutes, and it's not always easy for me. Sometimes I manage 5 minutes, sometimes I manage 10. But just the other day, I said, let's try 20 minutes again. It's been a while. And I noticed there's always that resistance. If people are familiar with Stephen Pressfield's The Art of War, not The Art of War, The War of Art, he talks about resistance. So I have learned that resistance is just a signal that it's almost as if the universe is pushing up against us, like testing us. Are you sure? Are you sure you want to go that deep? Are you sure you want to take that creative risk? Are you sure? And by showing up, by just being there with your writing, by writing on the page, I am showing up. I am confirming, yep, I'm here to write, y'all. I'm here to write. And I'm writing whatever nonsense I want to write. It doesn't have to be spelled right. It could be completely just like ping-ponging different parts of me talking to each other, arguing, inquiring, doubting. And then by the time what I notice, like a good workout, by the time I've done with 20 minute free writing, I am ready. I am warmed up. I've released all the chitter chatter inside of me. I have acknowledged all the parts in me that want to say, kind of go counter to my intention, distract me, worries. Oh, worrying about this client, worrying about that project. What if this? And oh no, I don't have that figure out. But if I notice what happens when I write all these things down, especially in the form of questions, it allows the part of my brain that knows how to solve things without me paying attention. I'm giving that away. I'm like, here, y'all, take it. I really want to get back to my story.
So when you're free writing, a lot of the time you're posing questions that need that need to be worked on.
Mm-hmm. Questions I don't have answers to. I think questions are one of the most, they're like the power tool to our psyche. Start asking yourself questions. You don't have to know the answers. It's not our job always to get the answer. The reason we have this question is because we don't have the answer. You know, where am I going to be in 5 years? What's the next iteration of my business? I don't know, but I'm just going to write it because my psyche is working on these things and I am worried and I am concerned. And so I have to write it down.
That's a form of self-talk. It's a form of self-talk. Do you do some self-talk outside of that? I mean, when you're walking, do you sometimes just, you're talking to yourself?
All the time,
Okay. So, and the reason I bring it up, what came to mind when you were saying, what you were just saying is a book I read years ago. It was told to me by a woman I met. It's called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself, written by a psychiatrist and basically reprogramming yourself or making positive inputs rather than the negative inputs that will generally run. So when you talk to yourself, what do you say when you talk to yourself? I mean, without getting too personal, I mean, what's kind of the tone there? What's kind of the, you know, kind of take us into that jet stream?
Yeah, I love jet stream. Absolutely. So I am inquiring a lot, like what's going on? I have a lot of things that operate below the conscious level for me. I have like this intense emotionality that doesn't have words. So I'm often asking myself, so what's going on, Beth? And then I listen for the answer. I'm listening to the body. I'm listening to whatever's ready to bubble up. But I'm also listening. I'm to the physical body. What's going on? Like I notice when my brain wants me to do something, but my body is, I'm feeling all in some kind of turmoil that's hard to articulate. I'm checking in, and I do that. Gosh, 5, 6, 10 times a day. It's like all the time. So that's one of the things. It's like what's going on, and then. Also just noticing, literally almost like noticing what's going on, hearing how I'm talking to myself. I've had to learn over the years to, you know, I was very abusive with my self-talk, very abusive, right? We grow up in ways that we're talked to in that way. And we just take it in, we take in the culture, we take in the family life. And I had to learn how to, instead of, I would often shake my finger at myself. You're not doing this. You're not doing that. Bad girl kind of thing. And I realized, okay, that's not helpful. And I learned through training with NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. I got really conscious of paying attention to how I'm speaking to myself. And then really almost like the energy is like, I put an arm around my shoulder. Like, hey friend, hey, my best friend, tell me what's going on. Just the way a real girlfriend speaks to me. That's how I try and approach myself. And also sometimes it's parental a little bit, like there's a little baby inside of me having a fit and I have to sort of there, you know, so yes. That's another role. That's another voice. And then sometimes it's like, come on, like encouragement, like a coach, you know, come on, you can do it. I know you said you want to do it. Come on, get off the couch, you know, you can do it. And then there's still the voices in me that are like, hey, you said you were going to do this, but you didn't. Come on. That's crap. You know, so give myself a little bit of hell. But I feel
go ahead. Finish that.
Yeah. I mean,
you feel what?
I notice there's the judgment also that comes in. And I feel like my job, my assignment lately for myself is just to notice, oh, look at all the ways I actually still judge myself and kind of put myself down a little bit. And instead of making myself wrong about it, I'm just like noting it. I'm like the court reporter going, oh, I noticed you said this to yourself. And so it's just sort of like
awareness, self-awareness.
Yeah. Self-awareness.
You know, the unexamined life is not worth living, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so much richer when we examine our lives.
Yeah.
It enriches our lives. I mean, we learn some uncomfortable truths along the way, but then you can act on it and you can change it, hopefully. You know, I was going to say that when you're talking, what comes to mind is kind of the child within or the inner child. And it reminded me of the time at various points in my life, I've done a lot of public speaking. And of course, like pretty much anybody, I get nervous before I'm going to go up there to speak. And I would kind of take that mindset of the inner child and the adult would be saying to the inner child, I got this. Don't worry about it. Just relax. I got this. And it was amazing how this simple framework or construct, how well that worked, because all of a sudden it was, it took me to a much better place. It took me to a higher level where I could literally feel the anxiety fall away. And not to say that it was completely gone, but it takes it from that very, you know, intense level to something that's just a little bit of background white noise, and was very effective. And it's just a simple mind experiment or a simple construct, and it works.
Yeah. I mean, look how powerful that was for you. And, you know, we give so much weight to the negativity and the critique and the should, and you should do it like this, but other people say that. We give so much weight to that as if it's the truth. Well, why can't the positive self-talk be the truth? Why can't the empowering, you got this, I got this, we got you, you know, why can't that be the truth too? They're actually both the truth, depending on what you want to believe in. So may as well make it a positive script or an encouraging script. I mean, this emphasis on negativity and needing to appear a certain way, I'm sorry, but to me, that's BS. That's just as much invented BS as anything else. So why not change the script? I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. So
we're creative people here.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, you know, if we're writers, right? Let's write our own story. Let's.
That's right. That's right. We can... Yeah, I mean, some people say, you know, change your story, change your life. And it feels very trite. It can feel very like new agey or whatever. But actually, if we look at our lives with a completely different light, if we start to validate how what happened to us actually maybe taught us something, even the hard stuff, even the bad stuff, then like, how can our lives be fodder for creativity? How can our lives be gifts that we actually give to ourselves and give to each other? Why not? Mm-hmm. You know, I really firmly believe that I'm here to be a force of good. I'm here to be a force of positive impact and to empower people. And why not flip the script? Why not create the lives we want? We don't have to do it the way other people have done it. We're creative people. Therefore, we can invent, we can create, we can remake ourselves. We can remake the world. And mm-hmm. I'm very, and you asked earlier, why science fiction? It's like, well, in science fiction, I can remake the world. I can reinvent how I want things to unfold for humanity. My stories are set a little over 100 years in the future. I mean, why not? And I'm dealing with a lot of backstory also that's about 40 years in the future, or 30 years, 30 to 40 years. I'm working very hard to come up with the pivotal stories that actually change humanity for the better. I mean, and I'm working with a whole bunch of other people who are also on that as well. I'm taking a great class called Thrutopia. I just want to plug it because it's so amazing with all these speakers coming in. We're all working to imagine what would life be like in 2030 if things were moving in a positive direction. And why not envision those stories? And why not write those stories and deliver them to the world? And therefore, we as humanity can imagine ourselves with that positive way where we are caretaking the earth, where we are caretaking each other. Why not? Let's use our imagination as a force for good. That's what I'm all about.
And you said Thrutopia.
Yeah.
Spelled how?
Thrutopia.
Well, let's see. There's a musical group called Thrutopia.
So
did you say TR or THR?
Sorry, THR. It's thrutopia.life, I believe, is the actual link. And I can send you that for the show notes.
So the Thrutopia Masterclass. Yes. Okay, here it is. Okay. Yeah. So neuro-linguistic programming. I mean, for all I know, mm-hmm. I've been hypnotized already. I'm under your spell right now. Our listeners may be hypnotized because you've been using NLP, as it's abbreviated. Talk about NLP. How does neuro-linguistic programming, how does that comport with your writing, or how does that feed your writing? Is it for that purpose at all?
Yes, absolutely. Neuro-linguistic programming, as I learned at NLP Marin, so that's nlpmarin.com. They have a transformational heart-centered focus. So we're not using NLP to manipulate. We're using NLP in the service of helping people have the change they want in their lives. And so with me, I was actually releasing, or had just released my first novel when I was training with them and getting my certification as a master's in NLP to be able to support, you know, help people with change work. And it really helped me internally on the marketing side at first, because I was kind of petrified about marketing my first book. And the NLP work that I received and learned, it helped me shift from my focus of fear to my focus on service. Like, oh wow, my book is actually, instead of being, oh no, people are going to see the real me through my fiction, and I'm scared about that and vulnerable, it helped me see, oh, my fiction is a gift. My fiction is a gift for the right readers. There's readers waiting for my book out there. Help me visualize those readers. Help me open my heart so I could offer my book as a gift to the readers. So that's where it helped me first. And then when I was working on the next book, it helped me get deeper into my characters, really, really deep, really get to know them even better. And I've actually embedded some NLP tools directly into how I help people plan their novel and edit their novels. And also, there's tools, I'm sure, around writing too, helping people with writer's block and getting into the flow of creativity. So it's helped me on all the levels, write, market, publish, everything, and other areas of my life as well. It's such an amazing toolkit to help us reframe. So we mm-hmm. can go from feeling kind of closed down and kind of inward focused and afraid and anxious to, feeling more stable, feeling more resourced, feeling connected and grounded, so that you can, you know, bring your gifts out into the world.
Well, and you've been doing that. You've written, 16 or 17 manuscripts? Some of mm-hmm. many, I don't know if those are all published or some of which are published.
There's 3 unpublished manuscripts. So I've just published my 13th novel. There's 3 of those books that aren't yet published, 2 of which will probably never be published. There is one of those is, oh no, maybe there's 17. You know what? I've lost track. There are at least 2
it's
books
a lot. It's a
in
lot.
The wings. Yeah. Plus books in kind of formation. Yeah.
What's your average length of your book? Do you try to stay within a Kurt Vonnegut length, like 250 to 300 pages sort of thing?
Yeah, or I would say so. I mean, the Janie McAllister mystery series, the science fiction mystery series that are out now, they're all about 70,000 words. They started out, I was using NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, mm-hmm. as my mm-hmm. guideline. And so the first drafts were all about 50,000 words. And through the editing process, they get about up to 70,000 words. And I like writing that length. They're fast-paced reads. The next books in the series might be a little bit longer. We'll see. I feel like now that I know my world much better, they might be a little longer. I've also written young adult adventure fantasy, and those range from 63,000 words up to, I think the second book was 83,000. And then the third book in the series was over 100,000 words, because I was weaving together, you know, 3-4 different plot lines. And that's kind of typical with young adult fantasy, where each book gets a little longer. But then I've also written 5 romance paranormal, sweet paranormal romance novellas, and those ranged from 20,000 to 43,000 words. So those were novellas. So I've played with a lot of different lengths, and here I am now working on a 7,000 word short story, which is unusual for me. I don't usually work in that short form.
Is that part of a short story collection you're working on, or is it going to be a standalone?
It's going to be a standalone, but it's a story within the series that I'm currently working on. It's part of the Janie McAllister mystery series. It's a little side story. It's not a big, dark, it's not a murder mystery. It's a little sweet, kind of sweet bite of a mystery, very light. And it's within the canon.
Is McAllister the favorite character you've ever created? If not, who is a favorite character ever created?
I would say I'm still very partial to Henrietta the Dragon Slayer. She's very much, and I'm working on a graphic novel series with her and her friends. She's very much very kind of closer to me, and maybe because she's very earthy and very earthbound, whereas Janie is on space stations, and I really love Janie. She's also my gal, but I'm still really attached to Henrietta. Mm-hmm. And feel her presence so powerfully. And it could be the length of time I've been working on her material. You know, it took me 13 years to put out those 3 novels. And now it's been, over 20 years. And actually more than that, because I first wrote a very, very short Henrietta story when I was 20 years old. So she's been living inside of me for over 30 years. And so that could have something to do with it. I'm attached. Wow. Yeah, it's fun.
Is there any one author who's inspired you the most?
Oh my gosh, I have been inspired by so many different authors.
So there isn't one that was really the beacon that drew you in, and then obviously others come along.
It's hard to say because I was such a voracious reader as a child, and I still am. I hesitate to name just one author. Sorry, it sounds like some construction going on. Just to name a few, if you don't mind, love Elizabeth Moon, who writes science fiction and fantasy, and she does these great spaceship captains, women spaceship captains. I just love those things, love those stories. She comes to mind. Anne McCaffrey, I read voraciously when I was a teen. She wrote the Dragon Riders.
That's you.
That's me. I know that. I am also deeply in love with Nnamdi Okorafor, whose beautiful little trilogy, Binti series. Oh, so fabulous. Talk about science fiction.
Let me ask you to offer, and this is another one where you're probably going to have a hard time just singling something out, but give it your best shot. If you were to give your best piece of writing advice to just the garden variety aspiring author, what would it be?
Timed writing. I'm a huge proponent for timed writing. Most of people's writing problems can be solved by training yourself to do timed writing. And you can give yourself a focus or not, or just free write. I really recommend 20-minute timed writing. Do one of those every day. Call me in the morning.
Why does that work? What's the power of that?
Oh my gosh. Well, firstly, people give up too soon and they put such high expectations on themselves. They think that their finished product, as soon as they sit down to the write, they think it has to be glorious. But actually, writing is incredibly messy. Or I should say, any creative endeavor is incredibly messy. So let yourself be messy, because first we're messy, first we put words on the page, then we fix them. So the biggest problems writers have is they are bringing their editor self into the first drafting stage or even into the planning stage. It doesn't belong there. Learn how to set your imagination free. Playing with 20-minute timed writing where you don't let yourself stop, you don't edit yourself, you don't censor yourself. You just learn how to write what's in your heart and in your mind. And you're also doing some physical training. You're learning how to connect what's in your imagination and your mind, bringing it through, essentially through your body and through, you could say, the mind, the heart, the throat center, which is our communication center, the heart, the arms, the hands, the fingers, and out, whether you're typing or handwriting, or even if you're dictating, you're going to shortcut that a little bit. But people just need to learn the physical loop of writing and how it feels, and that it is work. And if you learn to not censor yourself and just allow, that might be the key word. It's just allow yourself to express yourself, however, and know it's messy. Know it'll be messy, maybe grammatically, it'll be messy. It might not even make any sense when you read it again. That actually isn't the point of a first draft. The first draft is just to write, to see what's inside of you. And it might not even be a first draft. It might just be a bunch of material that you never use again. But most people need to learn the discipline of, and then that practice, that just like learning how to ride a bike or run or swim or jump rope. Like, we just have to practice. So getting into the habit of 20-minute timed writing, or if that's too much, start with 5 minutes. Or if that's too much, start with 1 minute. Mm. I recommend, do a part that's easiest, the shortest interval of time. And I sometimes recommend, like, if you're heating up your coffee and you're zapping it for 1 minute in the microwave, be in the kitchen with your notebook and write for 1 minute and allow something you already do, like putting your coffee for a minute in the microwave, allow that to be your writing time every day. So that's part of the ritual, the daily habit, the brushing of your teeth. Well, when writing becomes like a habit, like brushing your teeth, then your body starts to want it and need it. And that's how we develop the ability to sit down and write. And you don't have to shame yourself. You don't have to make yourself wrong. You just make it doable. And that's also where that lovely, like, parental voice talking to the inner child.
But don't make excuses either.
Don't make excuses, but make it like you would never expect.
Make it
doable. You would never expect a 2-year-old toddler to drive a car. If you're in Japan, you might allow them to go to the store because I hear that's a thing. But you would never expect a 2-year-old to like write a master's degree, you know, thesis, whatever. So if you're starting out as a writer and you've dabbled and you want to get serious, well, what is that? Maybe you already play games for hours on end. Well, that tells me, or maybe you sit and write a lot of emails. So you already have the ability to sit down and write or sit down and look at the device for a long period of time. So what if you just take some of that energy and divert it, like diverting a river? Hey, let's go in this direction. What if I diverted my attention? Let's play with 5 minutes. Pick the time interval that feels so easy. You're like, I could totally do that. Start with that.
Well, and if you actually sit down and you're going to write for a minute, you're going to go longer than a minute. You're going to start writing and you're going to say, I got to finish this thought. And then it's going to come along.
Absolutely.
So I think that's the key, is really just put yourself in the position where you're sitting down or you're walking and talking, whatever the mode of delivery would be, and mm-hmm. get going. And mm-hmm. when you set that very short interval, then you go beyond that and you feel like, wow, I knocked it out of the park. I sat down to do a minute and I ended up doing 7 minutes or 5 minutes.
Absolutely.
Or whatever.
Yep. So also what you're doing is you're training your psyche for the win. So allow it to be a win. Like, boom, I did it. I did my timed writing today. And then the next day comes and you do it. And you're like, boom, I did it. So as you build this success, then you start reaching for more. You're like, hey, I did 7 minutes. Tomorrow, how about 10? Let's see if we can do 10. And then you just give yourself permission to do what you're already able to do. And soon you'll see that, hey, if I sat down every day and for 20 minutes, and I, who only types at like 45 words a minute, you know, I can write 600 words in 20 minutes. So if all you did was 20 minutes a day and you did 600 words a day, which is actually a little over 2 manuscript pages, right? You're going to have a book, you know, in a few months.
And the critical part is to, as you were saying, you got to take the self-editing out of it. You write a sentence that's a monstrosity. It doesn't matter. Keep going. Don't try to go back and fix it. You keep forging ahead, because that's going to end up on the cutting room floor, and that's fine. And you mentioned messy first drafts. One of the great writing books that was written by Anne Lamott called Bird by Bird. And she said that you're going to write a shitty first draft. You will. And all those writers out there who you admire, who you think belong in the pantheon, they all write shitty first drafts.
That's right.
Nobody writes a clean first draft.
Yeah, there's a few people. They're geniuses. I've met them. They can write really. Yep. I have met writers who could write really clean first drafts. And, you know, that's awesome.
But don't put yourself in that category.
Exactly. Right? It's such a small percentage is what I've noticed. Most people write drafts that need to be cleaned up, and some a tremendous amount, like mine. My first drafts are pretty crappy. And so are my husband's. And we still to this day use timed writing as a way to get moving. You know, after a long day, he teaches high school and I might be distracted by all the projects. I'm like, you know, he'll say it out loud to me. I'm going to do my 50 words, and then he'll go off and he'll come back and he's like, wow, I did 250, you know,
and we
celebrate. Or I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to do one page, and then I'll come back and say, hey, I did 3, you know, so it's awesome.
Do you write for yourself or do you write for your audience?
I would say both. I write science fiction and fantasy adventures and mysteries and romance because that's what I love to read. And so I know I'm in good company. And first, the impulse comes from what I want. And then I think about the audience. Hmm. So I'm going back and forth constantly. And
so you're balancing the constituencies. You gotta love what you're doing.
Yeah.
But you have another constituency out there, the people who the reading public, and you do want your work to get read, of course.
Absolutely.
So, you know, we're over an hour, Beth, but I didn't have a chance. In fact, I never even talked to you about reading something for us. So here's what I'd like to do, assuming you're amenable, is why don't you record something? from and send it to me. And I'm going to do a subsequent podcast of this one where I'll just do a little intro. You set up the piece you're going to read and then go ahead and read it. And we'll just do a short podcast that way. You just phone it in, just send it in and I'll take it from there.
Okay.
So hey, thank you very much for spending this time. This has been very spirited and lots of good information from you. So, and I'm deep in hypnosis right now. Thanks to your NLP and so on. I just.
Well, but, you're so funny, Mike. We're always putting each other into hypnosis. I should just say everybody at every time, with every word we say, we're influencing each other all the
what
time.
A great statement that is. I love that. It's true because, for better or worse, and hopefully we that's one of the things, what you're saying, that's why we always want to be a positive influence on others. I'll tell us a quick story. The company, one of the companies I used to work for, there's a publisher of a newspaper, and I said, isn't the management part of it just a drag? And he would say, that's the part I love. And he says that anytime I have an encounter, all day long, I'm having touches with people. And I want to make sure that every time I have a touch with a person, they come away feeling a positive hit. And I thought, what a great way to approach management, which everybody just decries how management is just, there's just no real rewards in management other than a bigger paycheck. But with that attitude of, I want everybody who I come in contact with, whatever it is, I want them to walk away feeling like they've had a positive hit. It's a great mental framework to come from. Well, thank you for the time, Beth.
You're so welcome. And thank you. Thank you for inviting me. This has been so much fun. I love how we're just this wide-ranging conversations all over the place. Super fun. And I look forward to getting you an excerpt.